This is Leslie Hill recording his experiences in the TEFL field. I was born in Greece in 1918 and was bilingual in Greek and English from birth. Then, before the age of 10, I also learnt German and then French without any particular lessons. So by the age of 10, I already had considerable experience of natural language learning. Then at school, I learnt Latin and then Spanish by the traditional grammar and translation methods, so that I was able to compare the two. At the age of 21 in 1939, I had just finished my BA at Cambridge and was on holiday in Greece with my parents when the war broke out. And the British Embassy, to keep me in Greece because of my local knowledge until I was needed, got me into the British Council. And I was sent to Kavala in the northeast of Greece to set up an institute and to be its first director. There I taught English to adults and school children in classes both at the institute and in schools. At that time, the obligatory method was basic English. Unfortunately, we had no books yet, so I had to improvise at first. But then when the books came, we taught using basic English. I'd had no training, of course, any more than any of my other colleagues in the British Council at that time. Some of us became keen and successful language teachers, others did not, and either left or went into other branches of the British Council. One of our colleagues at that time said that those of us who had learnt to teach English as a foreign language had done so over the mangled bodies of their first groups of students. I at once enjoyed the teaching and found it stimulating. The only problem was that I'd started to become uncertain about my own English. The few books which I managed to get hold of from the British Council in Salonika sometimes disagreed with my own kind of English, and being completely ignorant about language teaching, of course, I often wondered whether I was wrong in my pronunciations, for instance. I also found the language used in the basic English course very bizarre. The avoidance of verbs, for instance, and their replacement by a few very common verbs and nouns produced English which to me did not sound natural, but we had to use that method. I finally managed to get out of the British Council and into the British Army in 1941 and spent quite a bit of the war, 3.5 years of the war in fact, as a prisoner of war, during which time I taught Greek to British POWs and English to Indian POWs. So I kept up my experience of language teaching, using, however, a very traditional grammar and translation method. During that time, too, I learned a lot of other languages, particularly Russian. With Russian, I used linguaphone records and found that by listening to a record over and over again, till my brain was really saturated, I could get the patterns of the language, especially the stress and intonation patterns, fixed in my memory. There were no Russians about during the time that I was learning, and it was only later, when we were moved from Italy to Germany, that I came into contact with Russians and was able to try my Russian out and to find, to my great pleasure, that I could communicate very easily in that language. I also used Hugo's grammar book and practice translation book for learning Russian, and I found that that kind of method suited me very, very well, learning the grammar parrot fashion so that I could recall it effortlessly, and also doing some translation and listening to tapes. I learned Italian very, very quickly as a result of my Latin and Spanish, and was translating the local newspaper for other prisoners during most of my time as an Italian, as a POW in Italy. Immediately after the war, I was on the British War Crimes Executive and head of the British translators and interpreters at the Nuremberg trials. And there I had a lot of practice of translation and was able to observe other people's methods of translation and problems of translation very, very, very much in detail. And I came to the conclusion then that translation was really a matter of empathy in the first place, feeling what the person was trying to express, not only the message he was trying to convey, but the attitudes he was trying to arouse and the feelings he was trying to convey. Then holding those in some non-linguistic limbo and then recreating them in a way which would allow the listener or reader to get the same impressions and the same feelings and the same attitudes as the original writer or speaker had intended. After that, I was interviewed by the British Council again and given a job in Tehran. And almost at once, I was put onto training teachers, as well as giving ordinary classes, and also I was put onto lecturing at the university and being director of studies of an institute which had about 24 teachers and 1,000 students. At that time, we were using Eckersley's Essential English, which was supposed to be rather carefully graded as regards vocabulary and structure. But I very quickly discovered that our teachers were having a lot of trouble using these books, and that they were complaining that they were coming across things in the books which were introduced surreptitiously before they had actually been taught. I therefore went through the first two books and found that they were absolutely full of examples of items, lexical, idiomatic and structural, which were introduced before they were supposed to have been introduced. So I very early on realized that authors tended, either deliberately or just by carelessness, to cheat, in inverted commas, on the grading of the books. At that time, vocabulary grading was very, very much in fashion, and one of the great gurus of that, of course, was Michael West. But structural grading, and particularly idiomatic grading, were very little known. I found that the classes in the Institute were very mixed. The students in any particular class were very mixed. So I instituted entrance tests, or grading tests rather, in which students had to do an hour or two's written test, choosing between alternative answers to particular lexical, idiomatic and structural difficulties, so that we could place them in suitable classes. The students did not like this at all, because they felt that if they were put into a lower class than the one which they thought they ought to have been, that they were being scorned. So we lost a lot of students, but we did have much more homogeneous classes as a result. I tried to choose items for the tests which reflected actual problems faced by Iranian students. And they were perhaps among the early examples of placement tests or grading tests in the teaching of English as a foreign language, which included lexis, structure, and idiom particularly. After I had been in Tehran for a year, year and a half, I was sent to Isfahan as director of studies, as director rather, and continued along the same lines there. I was then transferred to Indonesia as education officer and lecturer at the university. And after a year there, I was offered the professorship of English at the university, provided I got BA in English. I therefore went back to England, and I'd already been studying for some time privately. I spent a year at the Institute of Education in London with under Noonan and Patterson and Elliot, and also a year simultaneously at the Department of Phonetics of University College London under Gimson, getting ready for the phonetics oral of the London BA. During my time at the Institute of Education, I was very much influenced by the structural grading which Noonan in particular was doing. We had a course of structural grading. I didn't agree with him on certain points, for instance on the order of presentation of tenses in English, but on the whole I was very, very much in favour of his way of analysing and grading structures. However, I thought that his cavalier attitude towards vocabulary was not at all right, because I had found the vocabulary, particularly the different meanings of words, let's say back in this is my back, and the children are back at school, and to back a horse and to back a car, were considerable problems for students and had to be treated as carefully as structure. Also, I found that idiom, for instance, different prepositional uses, were also treated very cavalierly, and I was not at all in favor of that. But the thing that struck me most, and which I objected to most, was the fact that very, very little demonstration of methods of teaching was given to the students at the Institute of Education. They were given a lot of lectures and then pushed into classes in Wales, where the children were supposed, in schools where the teachers were supposed to have a Welsh mother tongue. And the lecturers then criticized the work, the teaching of these students, without actually ever having shown them how to do the things which they were criticizing them for not doing properly. And ever since then, I have felt very, very strongly that teacher training, certainly in the field of language teaching, should be very, very heavily example and closely supervised practice with short bits at a time on particular aspects of the teaching, and a minimum amount of theory. And I'm delighted to see that nowadays that is the practice very widely in Britain. I always suspected that the reason why teacher trainers didn't show people how to do things instead of just talking about them was because they themselves couldn't do them. Very often I found in India, for instance, later, that teacher trainers were literature lecturers who had been transferred to a teacher training college, never having taught English language to children in their lives, and that they therefore had to have recourse to theory, mugging up theory from the textbooks, because they just couldn't do it themselves. And they would then, when the teachers were doing their practice teaching, they would then come along very loftily and criticize what the teacher trainees were doing, although they themselves probably couldn't have done any better themselves and probably would have done considerably worse. After my time at the Institute of Education and so on, I got first in my BA honours of English and went back as Professor of English at the University of Indonesia. And there I had, in addition to running the Department of English and teaching English, I had to sit on the syllabus committee of the government of Indonesia, where we prepared a syllabus along very similar lines to those which Noonan had been lecturing about, except that we paid much more attention to vocabulary and idioms in addition to the grammatical structures of the language. Incidentally, on my way back from London to Indonesia, I spent a couple of weeks in Ceylon at the UNESCO seminar on the contribution of language teaching to living in a world community. And there we had a big clash between the lit boys and the lang boys. On the literature side were the French and those British who taught in Britain. They were supported by the Swiss. And on the other side, we had those who were interested chiefly in the problems of teaching the language. And those included Jack Bruton from India, and Ronald Mackin from Pakistan, and most of the Asian and African representatives. And we, in fact, formed a separate group in this seminar and prepared material and discussed syllabuses. And from that seminar, there grew a very strong movement, certainly in Asia, for the production of so-called structural syllabuses. When Jack Bruton and Ronald Mackin went back to India and Pakistan, they were instrumental in producing or helping to produce such syllabuses, and Wachendorf, who was the Indonesian representative at this seminar, and I were very strongly instrumental in the production of the Indonesian syllabus. The Americans, the Ford Foundation, were very active in Indonesia at this time, so they came in on this work, and this was probably the first time that Americans had managed to break away from Bloomfield and the very strictly structuralist anti-Semanticist school of American linguistics, because we put very considerable emphasis in our syllabus not only on the structures and the lexis and the idiom, but also on the meanings of these things, grading the meanings in addition to grading the structures and lexis and idioms. I also took part in one of the first, I suppose, cases of training teacher trainers. There was a 2 or 3 month part-time course for training teacher trainers in Jakarta, who later spread out all over Indonesia and trained teachers. After 5 years as professor at the university, I was transferred to India as chief education officer, and there, one thing that happened during my time in Indonesia was that I was consulted by the Ministry of Education there as to whether they should introduce basic English. This was before I became professor, during my year as education officer. And I strongly advised them to have a look at other methods of teaching English in addition to basic English before jumping on the basic English bandwagon. Well, this got back to London, and I was carpeted by the British Council and taken along to the Basic English Foundation to explain myself, because Basic English was still very powerful and important at that time. It had the backing of Churchill, for instance. And any attempts to undermine it were considered to be anti-establishment. I explained to the Basic English Foundation that I had not, in fact, attacked it. All I had done was to suggest that they should, that the Indonesian government should look more widely before deciding on Basic English. But they realized, of course, that I was definitely against Basic English. And I suppose it was a black mark against me. But gradually after that, Basic English faded out of the picture. And I hope that I was partly instrumental in its demise. Another point which I forgot about Iran was that during my time there, an edict was given out by the Controller of Education in the British Council Office in London that we were no longer to take part in the teaching of elementary English. That's English below the period of preparing for the lower certificate in English. A lot of us protested at this, saying, how were we going to train teachers if we ourselves did not have experience of teaching the same sort of thing in classes? Also, I pointed out in Iran that we made most of our money out of elementary classes, and that that money was what enabled us to have the advanced classes, because our classes were self-supporting, apart from the salaries of the British Council officers. Most of our teachers were local people who had been roped in to teach because of their knowledge of English. And it was a balancing act every term to have enough students in each class to pay the salary of the teacher. The British Council Control of Education was adamant, so we had a compromise. We were allowed to continue teaching elementary English, provided it was not done by British Council officers, and provided it did not draw in any way on British Council funds. Well, I managed to run this for a year so successfully that we had a large bank balance at the end of the year in the elementary teaching fund. And when the Controller of Education discovered this, he quietly changed the rules and brought the money into the British Council funds again and allowed us to continue teaching elementary English. During my time in India, there was a big controversy there between the structural syllabus supporters and the supporters of the old-fashioned methods, grammar and translation, and particularly literature. The old professors said, how can you teach English? How can you get people to enjoy the beauties of Shakespeare and so on through a structural syllabus? And of course, what we pointed out to them continually was that until they had a certain amount of knowledge of the language, they couldn't appreciate the beauties of Shakespeare. They wouldn't know that certain felicities of language were not the everyday language. Unless you know the everyday language, you can't compare it with particularly beautiful uses of the language. And in fact, one of the jokes we used to have was that the professors themselves spoke every day in their everyday language a highfalutin kind of English, which nobody spoke in England anymore, and which to our minds debased the beauties of English literature by using them in everyday conversation. But during my 2.5 years in India, I wasn't able to make much headway against these old professors, who still had very great influence, of course. But my colleagues and I, for instance, Lionel Billows, were certainly very successful in persuading state governments to give the structural syllabus a trial. During this time, I was still pushing very hard to in the direction of the semantic side of the structural syllabus, not believing that students could learn to use the language merely by learning lots and lots of structures. But that again was very difficult to get over. One used to go into classes and hear the children chanting, "I am a chair, I am a table, I am a blackboard," and so on, without any reference to the meaning at all. So that was the next big battle that had to be fought after the structural one. And it was a battle which had to be fought very, very much against the Americans still, because they were still very, very much under the Bloomfield flag and believed in mim-mem and first learning the structures of the language and then, in some miraculous way, applying those to the real world around them. In fact, their textbooks used to state explicitly that once you've learnt to make the noises, that you should then apply those noises to real life situations. But of course, that is one of the major difficulties of learning to use a language. And at this time, I started my own work on syllabuses, in which I believed very, very much that the teaching of the structures and the teaching of their application to real life situations should go hand in hand. In fact, what I said and wrote in articles was that there should not be stages, first of all, of learning to make the noises and then learning when to use them. The whole thing should be done at the same time. It is much more difficult, of course, to write material which is both carefully graded and at the same time useful right from the beginning. And that is why one used to get so much material which was really meaningless, where one was just learning to make noises and learning to do tricks. Standard Allen's Living English Structure, I always thought, was a very good example of this, because there one learns to do various tricks on isolated little scraps of language, isolated sentences, but there's no point at which one learns when to use these, how to apply them in real life situations. And that is what I was trying to do in India and have been trying to do ever since, to teach both simultaneously. And I'm very, very glad to see now that that there's been a swing towards communication, but at the same time a lot of people have continued to take an interest in the structural side. Because I think both must go hand in hand. It's no good throwing the structural side out with the bathwater and hoping that students will just pick the language up by casual communication in a classroom. It can be done, I'm sure, with small children if they're living in an environment in which they hear the language the whole time, but with class of, let's say, 3 40-minute periods a week, I think that is impossible. One must have something much more systematic in which the students have a chance of mastering one thing at a time, and also a chance to be able to use what they learn right from the beginning, so that at any point that they break off, they have a plateau of language which is usable and which they can apply to situations rather different from those they have actually dealt with in the classroom. After I resigned from the British Council in 1961 to become a full-time author and lecturer, I used to spend a lot of time travelling around the world, training teachers and lecturing and advising departments of education and so on. And one of the cases that I remember particularly was going to Malawi and having an interview with the president, President Banda, who was particularly interested in language teaching. And instead of it turning out as my advising him on modern methods of language teaching, it turned into a monologue by Dr. Banda to me on methods of teaching through grammar and translation. He said, that's how I learnt English, and that's how children are going to learn it in this country. So there wasn't very much I could say after that. In fact, I believe that small numbers of really highly gifted and intelligent people can probably learn languages best in that way. Certainly highly inflected languages like Russian and Hungarian. But I do not think that the mass of the population, the average school child, can benefit very much from methods of that kind. A certain amount of formalization of grammar, I think, does help. But it is very, very boring for most students, and also it just doesn't get through to them. So that it is really better to follow the present situational communication approach, while at the same time not forgetting, and while at the same time introducing structural and lexical and idiomatic grading. Apart from the controversies about basic English and structural grading and the necessity to grade idioms, which I have already mentioned, and also the controversy with the Americans over whether mim-mem and pattern practice was sufficient for language teaching, I also engaged in a pretty violent controversy over the length mark in phonetic transcription. During my time at University College London, the Department of Phonetics, Gimson had agreed with me that the length mark was in fact misleading for a lot of rather unsophisticated students and teachers and teacher trainers. And since then I had noticed very definitely that even teacher trainers were saying and writing that the difference, for instance, between the vowels in fit and feet was one of length, and basing this argument on the length mark. I therefore wrote an article to the English Language Teaching Journal pointing this out and strongly supporting an American type of transcription in which vowel quality would be marked rather than vowel length. McCarthy was commissioned by the British Council to answer this letter, and his letter appeared in the ELT journal as well. after which there was pretty violent controversy back and forth about this. The reason why Gimson had not come out openly in favor of my ideas was his respect for Daniel Jones, who still clung to the length mark. After Daniel Jones died, Gimson switched over, and since then the marking of differences in quality rather than differences in length has taken over very strongly in Britain as well as in the States. Another controversy which I took part in also in the 1950s was over structural grading. And again, I had strong arguments in articles. I think it was actually in the Indian magazine Teaching English, which I was editor of, about the, I had this argument with Michael West about the necessity for structural grading. He was very much still on the side of vocabulary grading and not interested very much in the structural grading, but I was insisting that structures needed to be graded as well. It wasn't enough just to stick to vocabulary grading. The another thing on which I had quite a bit of controversy was whether small children could learn a language more easily than older children. This was later, I think in the 60s or 70s, and Lenneberg was very much on the side of Penfield, Wilder Penfield, who the brain surgeon, who had said that there was an age at which children could learn languages very easily because of the plasticity of the brain and because of the fact that the two sides of the brain hadn't yet become rigidly specialized. In the 70s, I think it was, there was strong argument on the other side, mostly from Americans, saying that older children and adults could learn languages as well, if not better, than small children. My argument was, what do you mean by language learning? If you mean being able to do tricks on linguistic items in a classroom, then obviously the older ones would be better. But if you were talking about actual learning of communication within the limits of interest and knowledge of the child in its native language, then I was absolutely sure, on the basis of my own experience and that of my own children and that of lots of other children, that small children before the age of puberty were much more able to pick up a language perfectly than older children or adults. There are a few adults who can in fact learn a language perfectly from scratch, but I think it's very, very small compared to the vast number of young children who can do this absolutely effortlessly, even if the language is as remote from theirs as, let's say, Japanese is from English. Something that emerged from the 1953 UNESCO seminar at Neuralia in Ceylon may be of interest. There was discussion as to whether it is possible to think without language, and most people thought that it was not, that language was essential for thinking. But then some of the bilingual Ceylonese, bilingual in, for instance, Sinhalese or Tamil and English, said that they could think without language up to a certain point. And I then tried an experiment, being bilingual in Greek and English, and I found that was absolutely true. That in many cases, when I was really daydreaming, I did so pictorially or at a purely emotive level, and then suddenly I came up against something which I couldn't continue any further without abstractions, and I then had to search around in my mind for words in which to express this. And sometimes the words that came were German, sometimes French, sometimes Greek, usually English. And I stated this at the conference and found a considerable echo to this from other people who had been bilingual. So I think that it is certainly possible that bilinguals operate differently from other people in this particular respect. Cooperation with the Americans was also an interesting experience. In the 1950s, we had instructions from the British Council, and apparently the Ford Foundation had instructions from their headquarters to cooperate to the full in language teaching, and in fact, in Indonesia, we did cooperate very considerably. But I found that in the field, there was a very great amount of opposition on the American side. Not so much from the really competent and efficient people, but from those who were sort of half-baked, who'd just been given a short training and had to stick like mad to what they'd been taught, because as soon as they got outside it, they were completely at sea. For instance, there was a man who'd been trained, supposedly trained by Pike, as a phonetician, and he tried to do an analysis of the Javanese language, the phonetic analysis, phonemic analysis, and I discovered very soon that he was quite incapable of hearing the difference between aspirated and unaspirated plosives, for instance. And I just couldn't understand how anybody who had not had that elementary bit of training could set out to do a phonemic analysis. But he was apparently quite confident that it was quite unnecessary to have anything as practical as that. The Americans at that time were very strongly on the phonemic line. They didn't have proper ear training, they didn't believe in cardinal vowels or anything like that, so they were quite incapable of placing any particular sound in relation to other sounds, except on a purely phonemic contrast basis. I've also noticed that the Americans are very, very nationalistic and parochial about their linguistics. Very few of them know anything about what has gone on in Britain and the rest of Europe. And often I have found that they have claimed to invent something which in fact we have been doing for years and years and years. For instance, they are jumping on the functional bandwagon, the situational bandwagon. A lot of them were claiming that they in fact had discovered this and that it was a marvelous breakaway from the traditional Bloomfieldian structural approach. Whereas of course we had been doing that I'd been doing it for since about 1947. I have always been very suspicious of the relevance of applied linguistics to language teaching. I think that the important thing is to have a teacher trainer who is himself a successful teacher of the sort of students whom he's training trainees to teach. A person who can demonstrate different methods, who is capable of supervising practice teaching and seeing what the trainees are doing wrong, and who is capable also of giving a certain number of explanations of why he suggests certain things and why he is criticizing the student. The sort of teacher trainer who is a scholarly applied linguistician, I think, is a real danger to the profession. Unfortunately, they usually are the ones who have important university jobs and are therefore listened to by the people with the purse strings. This has been a rather rambling exposé because I'm a very busy person. I'd be very pleased to answer any questions which arise out of what I've said on this tape. I'm not going to do anything on the other side of the tape.